You're listening to Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're talking about refactoring web interfaces with Gina Bolton. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is brought to you by Hover, the place to register your domains with ease, and now, the place to register fun top-level domains. In fact, Hover just launched 56 new domain extensions. Can you believe we used to only have .net, .org, and .com to choose from? Now we have domain extensions like .tips and .today, and my personal favorite, which came to mind because of today's guest, .coffee. Register for one of these cool domains using the code REFACTOR, and you can get 10% off your first purchase on hover.com.
Control Click would also like to thank Pixel and Tonic for being our major sponsor. Hey, Leah, have you seen the news on Devotee lately?
Yes, actually. For those that don't know, Devotee has relaunched their forums to have more of discussions and stuff like that. Not just the support forums that are for specific add-ons, but like a general discussion forum. And one of the most popular posts right now is titled Paid Support Options. Mm. Yeah, so right now there's a bit of a discussion going on regarding whether add-on developers should start offering paid support options.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
Let's take, for example, one of my favorite add-ons, which is Low Variables for Expression Engine.
Mm-hmm.
If in order for me to continue to use it and my workflows are very dependent upon it, then I need to pay for support. Then I'm going to pay for support because it's kind of essential to the way I'm building my Expression Engine CMSs these days. I also trust Low. I trust, you know, he has an established reputation in the industry and in our community. So paying him for support, I trust that he's going to follow through on his end of the deal. So I'm not opposed to it. For me, it's a business decision.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, like as a consumer, of course, I would prefer that I'd pay just one price because I feel like, I mean, I'm not saying that there's only one way to do things or whatever, but as a consumer, I'm getting a little bit tired of subscription models. It's just like everyone is just another 10 bucks here, or another 10 bucks there or whatever. And that soon becomes like $300 a month, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as someone that, you know, really looks at expenses, I guess when you divide it all up over the course of a year, I guess as a business, you just have to decide whether that's viable for you and profitable for you. But on the other end, too, as looking at it in the developer's perspective, well, you want to make sure that the software is maintained.
Mm-hmm.
And that can't be done if no income is happening.
Yeah.
Right?
Building an add-on is one thing. Maintaining it is a whole nother ball of wax. I mean, I saw the announcement from the guys who made Mountie.
Yeah.
And they're discontinuing it because partly because of the where they've each taken their own careers and they're not really focused on Expression Engine these days, but that the reality of having to keep up to date with the versions of Expression Engine, that's they said it would be a whole new rewrite. I mean, that's worth time and money. So
absolutely.
And I want to see the add-ons that I rely on and feel make my builds better.
Yeah.
I want to see them continue. So yeah, I can appreciate what you mean about the subscription model. I feel it every month when they all send me my invoices at the same time for everything. But, you know, it's the cost of me doing my business. I will say, though, and this is not to discourage anyone from investing in add-ons, but if you're using a really good CMS, you can do a whole lot without add-ons,
too. Yeah, that's true. That's true. So. I think part of the issue, too, is, and this is mentioned in the thread, too, is there's an issue with documentation because part of the time suck of support situations isn't necessarily because of a bug or even because there was an incompatibility with EE or something. It's just because the person doesn't know what they're doing and they just find it easier, faster to email the developer or the developer dropped the ball and doesn't have good enough documentation. Like
that happens too often, in my opinion.
Exactly. So for me, I'm definitely pro paying for support as long as there's good documentation in the first place. Like if there's enough documentation so that I could troubleshoot it myself, that's really what I want to do. I don't actually want to ask anybody for help. And secondly, like whether it is fair in terms of, like, I guess the scale of problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that introduces a whole nother part of this argument that if the add-on developers embrace the idea of paid support, what model do they follow? Because, again, using low variables, I've never needed support for it. But what if one thing comes up, like an emergency?
Yeah.
Could I pay for that one-time support need, or is it something that you have to subscribe to? It's a can of worms. It really is.
Oh, yeah. And right now, like, for those that are interested, you should visit this paid support options discussion. We'll link to it in the show notes. And they've been riffing over the different types of ways you could do it. So not all of them were saying subscription models. Some of them are like, okay, what if it's a token situation? Mm-hmm. Where you pay like a flat fee on devotee of like $100 or $50. And then each question or each level of tier question is like one token. Mm-hmm. And then until then, it depletes it. So it's not an ongoing monthly expense per se. But then there's a situation where if that's the case, are all developers going to follow suit mm-hmm. with that flat fee structure, or some people will not, or is there going to be expiration to tokens? Mm-hmm. You know, those, anyways, it's a whole can of worms and it's way more complicated than we can discuss in like 5-10 minutes. But definitely, I think people should check out that thread.
Yeah, and I think it's important. There are a lot of developers talking about their perspectives.
Sure.
And there are a number of consumers. Whatever role you fill, get in on the conversation. And a little shout out to Eric Lamb for pinging us this weekend to sort of take a look at this and prompted us to discuss it this morning. So thanks, Eric.
Thanks, Eric.
Yep. So let's get to today's topic. We're talking about refactoring web interfaces with Gina Bolton. Gina is a designer, developer, and artist. She currently works at Salesforce as their senior product designer. She's also a renowned speaker and author of Fancy Form Design and the Art and Science of CSS. Welcome to the show, Gina. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Gina, can you tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I live in San Francisco. I've lived here for about 7 years now. It's weird to think about that. Before that, I was in Memphis. I've lived there for 5 years, and my hometown is Nashville. I moved out here for a job, and I'm pretty happy in San Francisco.
It's hard not to be happy in San Francisco. It's such a great town.
Yeah. A little expensive, though.
Yeah.
Every time I go to visit there, I'm, you know, I kind of want to move there. And then I just take a look at how much it costs to rent and to buy a house. And I just don't know how I would do it. Unless I had like 10 roommates, and I'm a little too old to do that. Yeah. So, Gina, today we're going to talk about refactoring with you. Can you tell me, what does refactoring mean when it comes to the web? Is it like a redesign?
No. Refactoring is to change the structure of your code without actually changing the behavior. So it's usually a code cleanup, but mm-hmm. it can be more than that. It's also like organization and trying to move towards a more maintainable code framework just to make like more efficient and easier to work with. But doing it in such a way that you're not really drastically changing the web app that you're working on.
Is it a situation where refactoring is an ongoing process, or is it something that you kind of set aside time for, focus on? Once it's completed, then you go back to the regular day-to-day work?
So I think most people do it the latter way, but what I advocate for is doing it iteratively and continuously as you're working on the project. Refactoring isn't something that happens very common on static websites or brochureware type sites, but on web applications that might iterate and evolve over time, I think it's important to make it a regular part of your process.
So when does refactoring typically come in during a project lifecycle? Do you just decide, okay, there's this new technique or something, let's just try it out on this one widget? Or should it start from the very beginning?
I think it varies from team to team. The way I prefer to approach it, again, is to do it continuously. And so anytime I'm making something new and I'm having to put it into place, if there's room to refactor something to make that better, I'll do it then. Or if I'm fixing a bug or changing up a way a component works or looks, then I'll go ahead and refactor there. And then, you know, if I get some extra time, and we like to call code or a tech debt time, then I'll, you know, spend some time doing some refactoring there. But usually I just try to make it part of anything that I'm doing, whether it's new or old.
So if you're refactoring and it's making adjustments to the code base without changing the actual functionality or features, I imagine when you're on a team, does it involve having is the whole team involved, or is one person responsible and then it's up to you to sort of communicate what's changed and then what needs to be followed moving forward?
That's also something that I think depends on your team size and how your team workflow is. In my experience, I tend to be the one doing a lot of the refactoring. I enjoy it. A lot of people don't like refactoring. I actually really enjoy it. But I try to do it in small iterative phases and not try to do like a complete total overhaul, because then it's easier for people to review what's been done. And we use pull requests to help manage that and make sure I'm not just going in there and changing everything around, you know, and sure, vice versa. So yeah, if you do it in really small iterative phases, then it's a lot more maintainable. It's easy to track and easier to review. So, you know, I always try to advocate for doing it in small focused areas rather than doing a big sweep.
Sure.
Right. In fact, your presentation, Refactoring Web Interfaces, you suggest starting at the element and working outwards. Could you maybe explain that in context of something you maybe done recently?
Yeah, so that tends to be like if I'm fixing a bug, maybe it's a UI bug, and I'm inspecting something, and I like to use Chrome Web Inspector. I think it's easy to start at the most small level. So maybe it's a button, or maybe it's an icon that's like off or something. I'll start at that most small element and see if it's fixable there. And if it's not, then I go one step up to the parent. And then if it's not fixable there, then I just keep crawling out until I find it, rather than just trying to do something at the top level that might impact a lot of other things.
It's interesting because I try to take that approach and I end up finding myself almost going down a rabbit hole. I've ultimately fixed the thing I was trying to fix, but I've already gotten into it and found a couple other things I could fix. And then the next thing I know, it's like 4 hours later and I've been quote unquote refactoring all day and happy as a clam because I love doing that kind of stuff. But do you have to put limits on yourself so that you stay focused and stay, you know, within budget or within the times for an allotted project?
Yeah, I think it's so important to stay focused. If I notice something else that needs to be fixed, I'll usually like write that down or make a task for it in whatever, you know, project management app your team might be using, and get back to it later. Because I think if you're doing code versioning, it's important to keep your commits focused. Mm-hmm. Again, it's about being able to review it, and it's also easier to revert a small commit than to revert a large commit if whatever you did didn't quite work out properly. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm refactoring something, I have to remind myself, you're just refactoring this one thing. Don't touch anything else, because you will end up in this rabbit hole and realize how long you've been in there. And then you realize you've done a lot more than you should. And next thing you know, you have this monolithic branch that takes like forever to review and try to merge.
Leia, I think that's a lesson I need to learn. Leia can speak to the fact that she'll pull something that we've worked on together and it'll have probably, I don't know, 24 things that have changed in it.
Oh, it's all good. It's all good. But this kind of reminds me of our episode when we had Jonathan Snook on and he was talking about SMAX and modular CSS. So we've been talking a little bit about doing things iteratively, little at a time, committing little changes, etc. But my question is regarding, how do you figure out where you even begin? Like, what do you tackle first? Is it usually, like, let's say you just got hired at a new app and then you're working on a particular app. What do you look first to refactor? What should be the priority?
You know, I'm a big fan of SaaS. And so first I determine if the app is using SaaS or any CSS preprocessor. If it's not, my first thing is to go ahead and get it started using that, because then you can start implementing variables and things like that. If it is already using one, then I can skip that step, obviously. So then the next thing I would do is I would just start with like things that could be turned into variables. So these are things like colors or fonts or type sizes, things like that. So maybe I might do a focused refactor on just typography. and just look for any repetition or see like exactly how many font sizes I have. And if I can like minimize it down to a really maintainable and modular scale, I'll do that. And then just try to make sure everything's following that scale. And of course, document that into a style guide. If there's not a style guide, then I go ahead and create one and start adding to it over time as I refactor. Sometimes I might start with color if I notice there's a lot of different shades of gray or a lot of different shades of blue. It's like, can I consolidate all that into maintainable color palette and then mm-hmm. let SAS do the variations on like darker or lighter versions?
So if you pick up something that's not already using a CSS processor and you're going to introduce it to the project, is that something where you leave the original code base and you just add to it? Or do you make a lot of modifications to that original code base to then work with a SAS preprocessor and some of the logic that comes with that?
Well, if you're using the newer syntax of SAS, like, you know, they have two different syntaxes. One is white space sensitive and looks more like Python in that it's like indented mm-hmm. to indicate when each selector opens and closes. And then there's the newer syntax that just looks like CSS. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a CSS file and just change the extension to .scss and then compile it, it'll just compile as a normal CSS file. And so you can kind of get everything moved over into SAS pretty easily just by changing all the extensions and not actually changing any of the code yet. Mm-hmm. And now you have SAS. You know, it's easy if you're on a Ruby on Rails app or, you know, some sort of framework that already has that as built in. But if mm-hmm. not, then depending on what the type of app is, then might have to add that in.
This is a slightly off topic, but I'm curious, do you ever pick up something that was using less, but you prefer SAS and you want to move it to SAS?
So I haven't had any web apps like that lately. I know when I first used a CSS preprocessor a long time ago when I was at Crush and Lovely. We worked on a project and we used less, but I was only using it to do like variations on color because we were doing visualizations that might need like darker and lighter shades of a color. Mm-hmm. So I was using less for that, but I wasn't really using anything else that it came with. The only thing I think recently that was on less and I wanted to change it to SAS was probably Andy Clark had that 320 and up framework mm-hmm. that he came up mm-hmm. with, and he did it on less, and I wanted to use it, but I wanted it to be SAS, so I ported it over to SAS, and then he ended up making it the official SAS implementation. And it's funny because now I understand he's moved over to SAS now.
So. So did you do that manually, or was there some sort of, I don't know, widget or grunt task that was able to kind of convert it for you?
Well, at the time, I'd never heard of grunt. So I did it manually, but it was just changing the extensions and then changing the variables from using @ to using $, and then I would compile it and see if it would run, and then it would yell at me about some sort of less does their mixins a little bit differently than SAS does, and their functions are a little bit different. And so I'd have to like kind of go until it would finally compile properly, and mm-hmm. it took a little bit of time, but it actually got me to learn a lot about less. And I feel more informed in my preference for SAS now from that process.
So that makes me wonder, what is it about SAS do you think that makes it stand out versus others for refactoring?
For me, it's the community. There's so many tools and so many components and frameworks and things that people build on top of SAS. And it just, from my perspective of what I've seen, it just seems way more active and way more maintained. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's important to use something that I feel is current. And I also just think it works better to my workflow. You know, variables look the way I expect them to look. When I'm searching for variables, it's easier to search by $ than @ because, you know, media queries also use @ And yeah, I just think it makes more sense for me. But personally, if you're using any CSS preprocessor, I'm happy, but SAS is better.
Well, it introduces the question then, if you aren't using a CSS preprocessor, does that mean that refactoring is more challenging, more difficult? Like, can you even refactor effectively if you aren't using something like that?
You absolutely can, but it just, for me, it would make life more difficult if I had to do it without SAS or any CSS preprocessor. I think it just gives you a lot of tools to make your job easier. I like to kind of use the whole like a hammer metaphor where it's like, you know, if you have the hammer, it's definitely a lot easier to get that nail in. You can find other ways of getting it in there. I also use that metaphor when people try to blame SAS for their output. And they talk about, oh, my CSS is really messy. SAS did this. No, not really. SAS is just a tool. You know, you could do a lot of damage with a hammer too. But it's really, if you know how to use it, it's really efficient and you can get your job done easier.
Do you work in the command line or do you have a preferred client that you use?
So it depends on what it is. Like for most of my websites that I do personally, I might start with Middleman, which is a Ruby-based static site generator. So it's got SAS built in. You know, a lot of the apps I've worked on were Ruby on Rails apps, and so it's already built in. So I would just write CSS in my text editor, which is Sublime, and then it'll compile just because it's built in. But if I'm working on something that is not built on a framework like that, then I'll often use CodeKit. And like at work, we actually use an Angular-based prototype that I work on. And so we actually use Node SAS, and it'll compile as I save and then uses like grunt and runs all these tasks and things. So there's a little bit of back and forth between command line and my text editor. But the only app I tend to use is CodeKit, and that's only when I'm like working on like something small and static, like maybe I'm doing a single web page or something.
Speaking of tools, you've mentioned version control a little bit. What tools are you using, one, if you're doing something personally, but then also what do you use with your Salesforce team?
So at Salesforce, we use the enterprise version of GitHub. It's basically just like a way of having GitHub, but having it internally, so it's more secure. For personal stuff, if it's just me, it goes in Dropbox. But if it's something that I need to collaborate with other people, like if I'm open sourcing it, then I'll put it on GitHub. So like, you know, I worked on the SAS website and I put that on GitHub, which has been really awesome because now I don't have to do all the work. People can like come in and help me, which is really nice.
So there's a lot of things going on when you're refactoring a site, and you mentioned documenting as you go. What do you think is the most efficient way to document? How do you document?
Obviously, I'm a big fan of style guides, and sometimes style guides are kind of also something that people put off towards the end. I think it's important to document as you go. So similar with refactoring, I think it's good to add to it, you know, as you're creating new things, make sure you modify old things. If you're modifying an old thing that's not in the style guide, then you should put it in the style guide. But I also think it's something I've only recently started using is automated generation of things through comments in your CSS. And so there are a lot of tools out there that do this, like Style.go is an example. So we do this at Salesforce. So I can write a component that what the markup structure would be and what the description is in comments in the CSS file. And then the page of components in our style guide will automatically display that component based on what that comment was that I put in with the description. And then we also use, we're exploring Polymer as a prototyping tool. And Polymer basically gives you a way of having these sort of, it turns your components into like these little modular pieces that you can kind of move around and like hook into real data. And so all that would be generated from, so we have like one central location where that lives, and we don't have to worry about editing the markup in the style guide or editing it in the app. We just edit it right there. And then propagates. It's pretty cool.
That sounds cool. That first one, when you mentioned that you would put like an example of the markup in your CSS comments, did I hear that right?
Yes.
That's awesome. That's a great idea. I've never actually thought of taking my comments to that level, although it would be really useful for some of our clients. And then the fact that that could then be converted into documentation or a style guide, that's fantastic. That was called Style Doco?
That's an example of one, yeah. There are a few others out there. That's the one I seem to see talked about the most. So, yeah.
What are those written in? Is it like in Ruby? Do you need to have special tools to run that?
So that one's written in Node, I believe.
Okay.
I think KSS might be done in Ruby because it's a gem that you install. I might be wrong on that. Mm-hmm. And then I'm trying to think of the other one I've seen. There's one I saw that was just sort of a drop-in like JavaScript file, and you would have a page set up, but I can't remember what it's called. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Now, in terms of the style guide that you mentioned that you're sort of documenting as you go, is that also, is it ever like a final style guide and then it becomes versioned itself, or is it just kind of a living document that you're just always updating as you're refactoring?
So I love using the term living style guide. I think a lot of people refer to their style guides as living just because it's up on the app, but they don't maintain it as they update the app. And so in that case, I don't really feel like it's truly living. But yeah, I try to make my style guide as living as possible. And what I mean by that is if I change or add a new color, I shouldn't have to go then open up my style guide and add that color. Like, it should just be there. So I did this using YAML data on the SAS website, but at Salesforce, we're exploring doing that with JSON. And so we just have like one central location where you can like put in your colors, your fonts and things. And then you don't have to worry about adding that new swatch or that new value into the style guide. It would just display automatically.
And let's say you've made an update, you've refactored something, you've adjusted the code base, the style guide is now updated. What's the next part of communication? Do you do like a mass notification to all your users of the app, or is it up to them to sort of keep tabs on what's been updated in the style guide so they know what might have been changed?
I think it depends on what the app is. So like, you know, for something small like the SAS website, it's just all on GitHub. So I don't really do a communication when it's updated. And I don't think it necessarily needs to be communicated for something on that small scale. For what we're doing at Salesforce, what we do could impact a lot of different teams. Like, we have an Android team, an iOS team, a web framework team. We have all the prototyping teams. And so we're actually working on improving that workflow now. And we've currently resorted to is central repository that has these new variables there. And then we have a tool that we built that generates all the different files needed for each of these things. So it might be a SAS file. It might be an XML file for the Android app. It might be a plist file for the iPhone app. But it's all generated from that one central location. But since it's in a repository, the different teams know it's there to pull in when they're ready for it, but they can do it when they're ready for it, so we don't just like start breaking things by like changing it automatically for them. So, you know, at that point, we would probably do like a communication, like, hey, new version is out. And then when those teams are ready, they can pull it into their code.
And how often are you totally working on your own? And how often do you have to bring in someone from, let's say, you know, with Salesforce, the Android team, because perhaps something you do would affect them? Is there a collaboration involved in refactoring? Or is it really you come up with a solution and then it's up to those teams to let you know or ask their own questions after?
I'm only just recently starting to communicate with other teams. I'm still fairly new to the team. But like so far, the experience seems to be that we would work with the teams throughout the process, but not like side by side. Like if we wanted to change things, we would have to just let them know that things are going to change. We also have this internal tool that we built that hosts like all our designs. And so we've recently communicated to all the different teams that anytime you need to see like the newest spec or the newest design for something, you would go here and see the latest and greatest. So personally, I'm making it my own personal mission to try to communicate with other teams more, but it's, you know, there's a lot of different people. And so, you know, I'm still learning who all those people are that I need to talk to. But yeah, it's been a good learning experience for me in understanding how something I do could affect something somewhere else. And actually, the team that I'm on right now is called Systems. And like our whole goal is to try to avoid issues like that. Like we try to design in a very systemic way and make sure that everything is aligned. But any changes that you make, we need to consider like how those changes might affect something somewhere that might not be totally visible at the beginning, but like maybe there's some page somewhere, some UI somewhere that we didn't think about that it could affect.
So why don't we get into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty of the actual refactoring? We got a question from our listener, Kevin Lozandier, and he asked, what's a particular code smell that drives you nuts because of its frequency that's easily avoidable?
That's the first time I've ever heard code smell.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty common on the engineering side. It's less common a phrase used on the design side, but yeah. So a big one is just letting your colors get out of hand. I see it so many times where, you know, people might like not want to document a new color, so they just kind of add it in, and then next thing you know, you've got like 30 different shades of dark blue. That's a pretty common one. I think one thing that drives me crazy is just overly specific selectors. Like, I try to make my selectors as small and flat as possible. And I think a lot of people that first get into SAS kind of see, oh, you can nest with SAS. And so they make it match their HTML structure. But in the end, you end up with the sloppiest, like, longest, like, CSS ever. You have to, like, try to keep things as small as possible, you know, as flat as possible. And that also makes it more usable. And so, you know, you don't have to duplicate anything or do as many overrides of things because you can just kind of reuse these little components throughout. So that's something overly specific, or styling based on where it lives rather than what it is, drives me crazy.
So, Gina, when you were sort of describing some of those little nuances, it sounded like you're aiming for like a dry principle, you know, trying not to repeat yourself too much. Are there any dry principles that you really follow when you're building UI interface that might be unintuitive for those who are unfamiliar with something like SAS?
Ooh, that's a good question. So I think like I definitely try to follow the dry principle of not repeating yourself. And we, at work, we always use the phrase single source of truth, and that kind of refers to making sure things only live in one place. However, I do think sometimes people over-abstract things. And so I forgot who, it might have been Chris Epstein that once said this to me, but it was to build it, and then if you find yourself reusing it, maybe make a note of it or see like if it's definitely probably saying this totally wrong. I'm trying to remember. It was something like, it wasn't until the third time that you see something repeated that you would abstract it. I don't remember. I don't quite remember what that second middle ground was.
So, well, you know, I find myself in that situation sometimes too, where I'm going into it and I'm trying so hard to be dry that I'm probably creating more work for myself with things that I wouldn't actually reuse somewhere. That they're not reusable, that they aren't things that are module that I would drop in every project or something like that.
Yeah, and so there's this tendency to want to abstract any and all instance of repetitive elements, but sometimes if you overdo that, you make things harder to find or harder to look for. Like you'd have to look somewhere and then you see, oh, actually it's over here. And then you see, oh, okay, actually this piece is over here because it's like abstracted so many times. Mm-hmm. So I try to like find a balance in abstracting things where they make sense, but not abstracting things just for the sake of abstracting things. Mm-hmm.
So as we wrap up this discussion, just a few final questions. What do you think is the biggest roadblock for someone to attempt refactoring an interface?
I think a lot of people try, when they think about refactoring something, they think about having to clean up as much as they can all in one go. And that ends up getting really overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you from my personal experiences, when you do that, you're going to end up with this branch that just sits around and never gets merged because it's just become way too big of an undertaking. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, I kind of use a lot of metaphors, sorry, but like around houses and like tools. But like if you're like wanting to remodel your house. You wouldn't try to remodel every single room all at once. You would just remodel like a room at a time. At least that's how I would approach it. Like you just focus on one room, you know, the kitchen, and then you're done with the kitchen. Now you do the bathroom. You wouldn't like try to like refactor everything, you know? And so I think with web interfaces, it's common to want to fix all the things like all at once. And I think that would make you want to hesitate, like, where do I, you know, how do I start? But if you already know going in, okay, I'm just going to do color. I can't touch anything else but color. I'm only doing color. Then I think it's easier to have a sense of where to start, and you will have an easier time actually finishing the task.
You know, and the way you describe that, it, you know, I'm thinking of it in terms of myself. I think I've I've made the rather unfortunate decision to do too much at once. And it does create, like you said, a branch that's just too massive, or there's so many changes within a single commit that it's harder to review. But also just me setting aside the time in my week. If I'm approaching it thinking I'm going to clean up everything, then I'm like, all right, I got to wait till I have, you know, a chunk of 4 hours, as opposed to, oh, if I just handle color, I can do that in an hour, hour and a half, and no problem. I can fit that into any schedule.
Yeah.
Since you have such a knowledge of SaaS and are so tied to the community, what are the top learning resources you recommend for someone who's just getting started, not just with SaaS, but with the whole concept of a CSS preprocessor?
Things that I would recommend, obviously, there's all the documentation on the SaaS website, but I totally recognize that that documentation isn't amazing and needs work. If you want to help me with that, please help me. But there's also, I like to read, his last name escapes me and I apologize, but his first name is Hugo. He's on SitePoint. And he always writes these great articles about SaaS features and like architectural tips and like how to approach certain common problems that you might face. So that's been like really useful for me to read, but that might be a little bit more on the intermediate to advanced level. For like beginners, I would say Chris Coyer does a lot of talk on CSS preprocessors on CSS tricks. That's a pretty good place to start. I watched this video on, I want to say it was on Code School, that, you know, I thought, oh, you know, I don't really need to watch this because I already know SaaS, but I got things out of it that I didn't even know you could do with SaaS. And it was still like at a very human-friendly like level of just teaching it without sounding like way too technical. I also think there's this tool called SaaSmeister that has been helpful for me to use when I'm teaching SaaS internally at work. So SaaSmeister lets you play with SaaS without having to get it set up, work within a web application. So it's pretty cool because then I can teach like certain principles of SaaS and like how to use it. And then the people I'm teaching can start using it and see what it's going to output side by side. And then they can save it to a gist on GitHub, or if they wanted to bring it into a project later, they could. But it's really cool for just playing with it without actually having to worry about like the setup. What else? There's a lot out there right now.
What about for getting into refactoring and kind of building a good workflow for refactoring? Are there any resources out there that you turn to?
You know, I don't know that there are a whole lot for like web interfaces, like in terms of like HTML and CSS, rather than, you know, there are a lot of articles that I've read, and I read SMAX, and, you know, I check out a lot of what people are doing with their different frameworks and things, you know, Zurb Foundation and Bootstrap. I don't use any of these tools, but I'd like to kind of see like anytime they make a change to those frameworks, what kind of changes are they making and why did they make those changes? But there's not a whole lot of actual tools that I can think of other than, you know, just like all the different things people are contributing towards the SaaS community. There's a lot of like things people are making to maintain your colors easier, things to make generating a style guide easier, or things to make your layout system easier. Like people are creating all these different tools to help make that process easier to maintain. And, you know, there are tools out there that do that without SaaS too, but obviously I kind of look towards the SaaS ones.
All right. So before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better. Are you ready?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
So first question, Mac OS or Windows?
macOS.
What is your favorite mobile app?
Ooh, Instagram.
What is your least favorite thing about social media?
Hashtags. Even though I use them.
What profession other than yours would you like to attempt?
Interior design.
Cool. What profession would you not like to do?
One that I've already had to do before, anything sales related, like telemarketing.
Who is the web professional you admire the most?
Dan Cederholm.
What music do you like to code to?
Witch House. It's a weird genre of music that's a blend of lots of others, but yeah.
What's your secret talent?
Secret talent. I have this weird knack for, like, I'll talk about something and then I'll check time hop and then see that whatever I'm talking about happened exactly 1 year ago today. It happens a lot. It's really weird.
What's the most recent book you've read?
SaaS for Web Designers by Dan Cederholm.
Lastly, Star Wars or Star Trek?
Star Wars. I like both. That's hard.
All right. So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
So I'm at Gina, spelled J-I-N-A, at Twitter and Instagram and GitHub and some other sites. My website, which isn't really much right now, is gina.me or also sushiandrobots.com to go to the same place. You know, I might relaunch that site soon. But yeah, mostly Twitter and Instagram, Gina.
Great. Thanks again, Gina. It was so great talking to you.
Thank you.
We'd now like to thank our sponsors for this podcast, Hover and Pixel and Tonic.
We also want to thank our partners, Arcus Tech, Devotee, and EE Insider.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Click Cast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com.
Don't forget to tune into our next episode when Jason Varga is joining us to talk about e-commerce with Statamic. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, controlclickcast.com/schedule, for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.